I'm a big fan of Game of Thrones. Do you like that one? It's a little bit violent, but it's a pretty good show. Downton Abbey is more my wife's speed. And in each of those cases, and like in similar shows like Homeland, you've got episode after episode. And because often there are big breaks between episode or season one and season two, you have to have sort of a catch-up at the beginning of the subsequent episode so you can be brought back up to speed as to where you were. Well, that's our situation today. We're in the middle of a three-part series all about a fellow you've heard of, but you probably don't know much about. His name was Patrick Henry, and he lived at a place called Red Hill. I went out for a visit, and I learned so much. It's just going to take me a little while to tell you all about it. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and our subject is Patrick Henry and Red Hill, Part 2.
Your weekly constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
Mark Cuvion is a man with a mission, and his mission can be summed up in two words: Patrick Henry. From a very early age, Mark told me recently at a place called Red Hill in Virginia, from a very early age, Mark was, I won't say obsessed with Patrick Henry, I will say he was very, very interested, and he's made a lifelong study of the great man. He's even published several books about him. Now, I met Mark recently when I took a trip out to this place called Red Hill, a place I'd never visited before, and I was ably assisted by two lovely ladies who work at Red Hill. Their names are Hope Marston and Myra Trent. And Hope and Myra introduced me to Mark, and Mark and I sat down and we just talked for hours. And that's why this is part two of a three-part series on Patrick Henry and Red Hill. In part one, Mark told me all about Patrick Henry's early life, about his becoming a lawyer, about his revolutionary activities. Now in part two, we're going to concentrate on his many other accomplishments, things you probably know a little bit less about, things like being the governor of Virginia, things like going at it with Thomas Jefferson and James Madison over issues like religious freedom, even some of his later life. In part one, we finished up with the famous "Give me liberty or give me death" speech, and then that's such a pivotal point in Patrick Henry's career. I'm going to replay the last couple of minutes from the end of part one, but I don't think you're going to mind.
And what's the actual quote? Now, I've heard it said several different times, but what point does he actually get up and make, and what actually does he say?
Well, yes, and this is the idea that every speech, there is something behind it, as
right.
I mentioned in the beginning. So to support his resolution to arm Virginia, the speech itself is probably about 25, 30 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, he says, gentlemen may cry peace, peace, but there is no peace. The war has actually begun. Why stand we here idle? And what is it that gentlemen wish? What would they have? Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. And the interesting...
Well, you have to stop there. I mean, it's been 200 years plus.
Yeah.
And those words just still ring down the centuries, don't they? I mean, that guy had a way with words, and I bet he was standing up in a ringing voice, and it was echoing. I've been to that church, and I know the setting, and I encourage people to do that. So what's the name of the church again, so people can go?
St. John's Church.
And it's still there.
Yep.
Okay, you can go and sit in the pews, you know, basically across from where he was, and I encourage people to do that, because that'll really set it up for you. And that was an amazing moment.
And just a side note, back then it was called Henrico Parish Church, mm-hmm. St. John's Church. That name is attached to it about the 1820s.
Okay.
So, yes. And it's interesting, Patrick Henry had a ivory letter opener. And in fact, we have it on display here in the museum. And when he said, give me liberty, he held it up. And when he said, or give me death, he thrust it to his breast like a dagger.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the men who wrote about what they saw that day, they all mentioned that his actions reminded them of Cato, the martyr, and that he would rather die than live under Caesar. Mm-hmm. And so this image of, you know, being stabbed, being in chains, was a very classical image that these people would have recognized and did as a comparison to Cato.
Sure. As educated men, many of our founders, if they didn't speak Latin, they could at least read some Latin. And
yes,
they were very familiar with Roman history, and they would make these references frequently. So that was very effective rhetorical technique, especially for that audience.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. Gives you chills, even after all this time. Kind of wish we could be there.
Yeah.
Could have been there. Okay. So he makes the famous speech, and of course, that one just sends him into the stratosphere in terms of his notoriety or his fame across the colonies. And so what happens next?
Oh, and it's interesting that some of the first...
Well, I have to ask, did they pass the Militia Act?
They do. It's a pretty close vote. It only passed by about 5 votes. So, I mean, without that... speech.
You probably put it over the top.
Yeah, probably would not have passed the convention if he didn't give it his all when it came to eloquence. So now you start seeing these independent militia companies form. Dunmore gets word of these companies forming. He's not happy at all. So what he does is he starts looking towards the Powder Magazine at Williamsburg, which still stands. And he decides that gunpowder might end up in the wrong hands, these militia companies. Mm-hmm. So on April 21st, he orders a group of Marines in the middle of the night to go and confiscate the gunpowder for the colony. And he has it placed aboard a British warship in the York River.
Mm.
So with that discovery the next day, people are up in arms. You know, why is the governor removing our powder? And... what happens 2 days earlier in Massachusetts, the gunpowder and weapons are taken at Lexington and Concord.
Mm-hmm.
So when news of that event hits the people of Williamsburg, about 10 or 15 days later, and their gunpowder...
So late April of 1775.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, and their gunpowder is now stolen. People believe that there's a huge conspiracy afoot to rob them of their means of defending their rights.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is Patrick Henry, he's going to lead the first act of war in Virginia. He's going to call up the Hanover Independent Company and march towards Williamsburg to demand the gunpowder back or to fight.
So Patrick Henry's making war...
Yeah.
In early 1775.
Yeah, and Dunmore is in a tizzy. He sends his family aboard the British warship. He arms his servants and slaves at the palace waiting for a fight. He puts cannon outside the governor's palace. And,
which is still there and which you can still go see.
Yes.
Okay.
And so Patrick Henry and his men and, of course, other militia companies are joining the Hanover Company. He gets about 16 miles from Williamsburg. In a place called Duncastle, and he probably has probably upwards of 300 armed men with him. Dunmore hears who's leading the men, how many there are, so instead of starting a war, he decides to pay for the gunpowder if Patrick Henry would call off his troops. So
to pay for the gunpowder?
Yes. So what happens is Carter Braxton... he is the son-in-law of the receiver general of the colony, Richard Corbin. He rides up to Patrick Henry, and he says that, you know, the receiver general of the colony who collects the royal money, if you call off your men, we will pay for the powder that Dunmore took. So I believe it was some 330-pound note, promissory note, that Patrick Henry accepts. And so he calls off his men. And eventually when he goes to Congress to attend the Second Continental Congress, Patrick Henry will use that money to purchase a ton of powder out of Baltimore. And so once Patrick Henry's
back... And then send it back to Virginia?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So once Patrick Henry is back in Hanover, the men are dispersed. Dunmore gets his courage back, and he, about 5 days later, declares Patrick Henry roughly an outlaw. He prints a proclamation saying that no one is to aid or abet Patrick Henry. And this really just makes him more of a hero amongst the populace, that mm-hmm. he stood up against the governor. He got the payment for the powder. And it was shortly after that that Lord Dunmore, in June of 1775, realizes he's no longer safe in Williamsburg, and he slips out the back door, boards a British warship in the York River, never sets foot in the city again. Mm-hmm. So with his departure, that pretty much ends royal authority in Virginia. And ironically, a year later, Patrick Henry will come in the front door of the palace as the first elected governor of Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Well... I did not realize the details of that face-off. Now, I'd realized that Dunmore had left like a thief in the night. I guess I hadn't realized it had been Patrick Henry who had almost literally pushed him out at the point of a bayonet.
Yeah, and it raises so many questions. What would have happened if he got to Williamsburg? Is he going to kidnap or hold the governor for ransom until the captain of the British ship returns it? If the governor dies in the fight... You know, or how many British troops would be sent to Virginia? Something just raises so many, you know, what ifs.
Yeah, the war eventually came to Virginia, but not for quite a while. And I imagine the British troops would have shown up much earlier had Lord Dunmore been held hostage or killed.
Yeah, they had only about 50 Marines. There was one or two British warships in the Chesapeake. And Dunmore did ask for their aid, but again, just a small number against the force that was coming down.
So Henry comes back, he gets elected governor. Of course, we have Declaration of Independence, right?
Yes, he actually attends the Second Continental Congress. Most right. people aren't aware of that. There's two sessions. So he attends the first part right after the gunpowder incident. He then heads to Philadelphia. He casts his vote for Washington as commander-in-chief. Mm-hmm. During the brief hiatus between the first and second sessions of the Second Congress, the Third Virginia Convention, meeting back in Williamsburg, they elect Patrick Henry commander-in-chief of the newly raised forces of Virginia. Mm-hmm. So he leaves Congress to take on this new role as commander-in-chief of the Virginia forces. The Third Convention would raise two regiments. And Patrick Henry was colonel of the 1st Regiment. William Woodford was colonel of the 2nd Regiment. And unfortunately, this body, the Committee of Safety, was a group of men that controlled the army. And what I say unfortunately is a lot of Henry's old political adversaries were in control of that body. Mm-hmm. Edmund Pendleton in particular, who did not care for Henry's politics. His next-door neighbor was William Woodford, mm-hmm. commander of the 2nd Regiment. And so he's trying to, he's very afraid to give Patrick Henry field command because Patrick Henry has not been tested in a real war. He was not in the French and Indian War, mm-hmm. where Colonel Woodford was a junior officer during the French and Indian War. And he also doesn't want Patrick Henry to win any military laurels to make him more popular amongst the people. So the Committee of Safety basically keeps Patrick Henry in Williamsburg, and every field command they give to his second in command, Colonel Woodford. He's the one who faces Dunmore at Great Bridge. Lord Dunmore is going to raise the King's Standard after he leaves.
Wait a second, I thought Dunmore had left in the ship, but he came back.
Yes, after he leaves Williamsburg, he heads down to Norfolk. He prints a proclamation saying that he will give freedom to any slave belonging to a rebel master if they would take up arms and join him. Also, Tories are running to him to the King's Standard. And so he creates this makeshift army of black soldiers, Tories, and a handful of regular British soldiers. And they're soundly defeated at the Battle of Great Bridge by the 2nd Virginia Regiment. And so after that defeat, Dunmore heads to New York, where he spends most of his the revolution. Patrick Henry, meanwhile, is incensed. As commander-in-chief, he is supposed to be the one being sent out to field command, and he's being passed over every time. Woodford now has these military laurels and praise, And so you start seeing people like Thomas Jefferson and other friends of Patrick Henry encouraging him to leave the military and go back into the legislature where he was more productive. And so he finally decides, after 6 months of disappointment, he turns back his commission just in time to enter the Fifth Convention. And that's the convention that's going to declare Virginia free and independent.
We're in the spring of 1776.
In May of 76.
Okay, so he's there for that. House of, you said it's the Fifth Convention? So this is no longer being called the House of Burgesses.
Correct, because only the governor has the authority to call the legislature in the session.
Okay.
So to keep it all legal-like, they're calling themselves a convention, not the House of Burgesses.
Okay.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and you're listening to part two of a three-part discussion with a fellow by the name of Mark Cuvillon, who's telling me all about Patrick Henry and his home, Red Hill. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll continue our fascinating discussion with Mark Cuvillon. Stay tuned.
When the American Revolution began, James Madison was under very early and strong impressions in favor of liberty, both civil and religious, as he wrote in an autobiographical sketch. He worked extensively for the freedom of Baptist preachers who had been jailed for dissenting from the established church. Happily, it was not long before the fruits of independence and of the spirit and principles which led to it included a complete establishment of the rights of conscience, he wrote, without any distinction of sects or individuals. Madison played an important role in establishing the rights of conscience during the 1776 Virginia Convention. Acutely aware of his youth and inexperience compared to the distinguished and experienced members of the convention, Madison did not join in the debates. He did, however, propose a small but profound change in George Mason's wording of the Virginia Declaration of Rights. Madison successfully argued that the Declaration of Rights should be amended to express the right to free exercise of religion. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And now let's continue our discussion with Mark Cuvillon, who's an interpreter at Colonial Williamsburg for his day job, but who knows an awful lot about Patrick Henry. Before the break, we were talking about Patrick Henry's pivotal role in the American Revolution. And let me give you a hint. It was not just about one speech.
So they assemble in this Fifth Convention. They pass the resolution
declaring independence.
Declaring independence now, and or proposing to the Second Continental Congress.
On May 15, 1776, Virginia declares itself independent, or these men declare Virginia independent, and then they send that resolution to their delegates in Congress, asking that all the colonies declare independence in one motion. And so, yes, Virginia was technically a sovereign state about 2 months before the Declaration of Independence was passed by all the colonies up in Philadelphia.
That's interesting, you know, because Delaware calls itself the first state because it was the first to ratify the 1787 Constitution. But it seems to me Virginia may have the claim of being the first state. Was it the first of the British colonies to declare itself independent?
There's some say that North Carolina beat out Virginia. I think Rhode Island tries to claim that as well. But what Virginia
Rhode Island claims all kinds of things. Go on.
And in fact, Patrick Henry was, it was his resolution that stated that Congress should declare independence. So that's the big thing that Virginia did, is their resolution was sent to Congress and that all the colonies acted upon Virginia's resolution.
Man, this is filling a lot of gaps, certainly in my knowledge of what all, you know the basic outline, but a lot of this stuff is now making a lot more sense. And I'm guessing right around that time is when Patrick Henry gets elected governor.
Yes, they go to work on a Declaration of Rights and a new state constitution.
George Mason.
For Virginia.
Right.
Yes,
so
George Mason, Madison, that's he comes into the legislature.
Madison, that's right.
Edmund Randolph, that's his first year. Of course, Patrick Henry's involved in that as well. And on June 29th, 1776, they adopt the Virginia State Constitution, and the Fifth Convention also elects Patrick Henry the first governor of the new Commonwealth. It's not without opposition. There was Thomas Nelson Sr., who was a member of Governor Dunmore's council. Mm-hmm. He was the secretary of the colony. There were many votes cast for him. Mm-hmm. They thought it was a way to maybe bring the radicals and more conservative men together. And because of his executive experience, they thought he would be a better person to become governor. But Patrick Henry receives 60 votes. Nelson receives 45, and John Page 1. Nelson is then asked to be on Patrick Henry's council, and all of a sudden now he's too old to be in office. It was fine when he had his name, but sure. Now that he's beat by Patrick Henry, he decides to retire from government.
Sounds like sour grapes
yeah,
to me.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
And John Page received that one vote. He becomes Patrick Henry's lieutenant governor. What's interesting is right after he's elected governor, he comes down with malaria and almost dies. In fact, John Page goes to Patrick Henry's lodgings in Williamsburg, and he makes Patrick Henry take the oath basically on his deathbed. And Page writes to Jefferson that if Patrick Henry dies, it's going to throw this new Commonwealth into confusion. You know, they're going to have to get a new election for a new governor.
Mm-hmm.
And so Patrick Henry is sworn in. He heads off to his new home in Scotchtown, and he's out for about 3 months recovering before he finally arrives in Williamsburg.
Wow.
to the palace.
That was a serious illness.
Yeah, there were many rumors circulating that he had died.
Wow.
Archibald Carey, who again was one of Henry's political opponents, he wrote in his diary that he rejoiced when he heard news of Patrick Henry's death.
Nice guy.
Yeah.
Nice
so
guy.
Landon Carter as well. You had a number of people that, these old guard as they were, not liking Patrick Henry.
Well, he was a firebrand. And some people, you know, we look back on history and it looks like everybody was on the same page and we were all revolutionaries and, you know, down with the redcoats and all that. But there was a lot of discussion, a lot of disagreement, and Henry was on the left. He was the radical fringe, if you will, that eventually won out and eventually prosecuted the revolution to its conclusion. But that was not inevitable, and there were a lot of people who didn't want to do that. I mean, including, as you mentioned before, Benjamin Franklin. He was still over in Britain trying to get everybody back together.
Yep.
Okay, so he becomes governor. He recovers from his illness. Then what did he do during the war?
Yeah, he spends, he's elected governor 3 terms in a row. At this time period, in under the Virginia State Constitution, after 3 years, you had to step down from office for at least 4 years before you could be reelected. And so he's basically governor during most of the war. Most of what he's doing is writing warrants, paying for things that people are doing for the war effort,
mm-hmm.
Trying to get the quota of troops needed, not just for Washington's army, but to keep up the militia and state troops at home. He's one of the biggest things he does is sends George Rogers Clark out west in 1778 to capture the forts in the Illinois Territory,
mm-hmm.
Kaskaskia, Vincennes. They'll attack Detroit. And
correct me if I'm wrong. At that time, because of the way the colonies had claimed pretty much, you know, as far west as they could think of, there are many people who would at least claim at that time that those territories were part of Greater Virginia.
Yes.
So maybe is that the reason he felt it was appropriate for him to be sending people out there?
Exactly. Or after the French and Indian War, Virginia's boundary was placed from the Atlantic to the Mississippi River and up to the Great Lakes.
Mm-hmm.
So that did fall into territory of Virginia. And of course, the British, they're controlling these forts. And he's aware that if they still control them at the end of the war, that that part of Virginia will become basically part of British Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted to make claim to that part of Virginia. And of course, the British governor, Governor Hamilton, out of Detroit, he's raising up Indian war parties to attack Virginia settlers. So this is basically killing two birds with one stone, try to claim that land for Virginia if successful, and to put an end to these Indian raids being sent out by the British governor of that area.
And Clark was pretty successful, wasn't he?
He was. He captures Henry Hamilton, brings him in chains to Williamsburg, and that pretty much ends the Indian attacks upon the frontier. That puts a huge damper on it.
Didn't quite dislodge the British from the Great Lakes. That
Correct.
Took, that took another war later on, but
yep.
But he did. He made some progress.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. All right. So that's most of what he does during the war. Now, eventually, of course, the British come down to Virginia during the war. And what did he do then?
Yeah, unfortunately, the last month of his term as governor, there's a surprise raid into Virginia by Major Collier of the British forces, and they destroy much of the naval stations, the ports around Portsmouth and that area. And they're in Virginia for about 2 weeks before the militia is able to be called up and show enough force for the British to head back to their ships. So yes, he kind of ends on a bad note. But as you probably are aware, Thomas Jefferson's going to have a bit more problems with the British. And
now, did Henry decide to leave office, or was he required to leave office?
He was required after the three terms to step down.
Okay, so he was term limited out of office.
Although there were a number of people that wanted him to run for a fourth time, stating that it was the Fifth Convention that elected him and not technically under the new Constitution.
Okay, so he had an argument that his first term was not part of the limit.
Yeah, but he said, you know, let's stick with the spirit of the Constitution.
Okay.
So he steps down and heads back into the legislature, and then Governor Jefferson takes his place as governor.
And then things went really south, and Jefferson ends up running away off to Poplar Forest, actually, to run away from the British. What was Henry doing during all this time while the British are rampaging in the
Southland? Well, yes, the Virginia legislature is trying to stay one foot above or in front of the British troops. Tarleton and his dragoons were sent out to capture the Virginia legislature.
Well, I bet they would have loved to capture Patrick Henry.
Yeah, they do capture his stepbrother, John Sim, who will be traded later. But, yes, yeah, so they go from Richmond, which is now the capital in 1780, not Williamsburg. Then they move to Stanton and to Charlottesville. They're just trying to get away from the British. And it's that raid by Benedict Arnold and then followed by Cornwallis into Virginia that is going to create the animosity towards Jefferson and Patrick Henry.
Jefferson. Benedict Arnold, by this time, had done his treason.
Yes, he's now
a brigadier general, right? Wasn't it for the British?
Yes.
Okay, so he's working with Cornwallis down in Virginia, causing all sorts of problems for Thomas Jefferson and for Patrick Henry. And you're saying that those problems, well, I guess Henry started criticizing Jefferson, or what happened?
Yeah, what happens is, unlike the raid when Patrick Henry was governor, George Washington sent letters to the governors in the southern states saying that a British fleet is likely on its way from New York to basically be prepared. And so for whatever reason, Jefferson, he claims it was too expensive to keep the militia embodied, but he didn't even put pilot boats on the rivers to watch to see if the British Navy was going to enter the Chesapeake. And so the British Navy does, the British Army's landed, and Jefferson, as you mentioned, kind of flees back to Monticello, and an inquiry...
Eventually has to flee from Monticello,
and then
and eventually hides out at Poplar Forest, right not far from here.
Yes.
Okay.
So right after the British leave that area, George Nicholas introduces in the legislature that basically an inquiry should be raised towards Jefferson's actions, why he didn't prepare. And Patrick Henry II, that motion. So basically, it was the start of an impeachment process towards the governor. And Jefferson, when he heard that his friend was, you know, involved in this, Patrick Henry, from that point on, the two split, and the animosity towards each other just grew and grew. Jefferson, in his first letter to George Rogers Clark after this inquiry, he starts attacking Patrick Henry as being all tongue and no heart, that he's a coward and so forth. And it just gets
all
worse.
All hat and no cattle, we would say today, or has been said today about some Texas politicians. Okay.
Yes. And of course, Jefferson will never give Henry any good motives for doing it. Nicholas will reply that, you know, the elected officers serve the people, and we have the right to demand from them their actions to be accountable. And most likely that was also Henry's thought on it. And shortly after the inquiry was raised, Yorktown takes place. British are defeated. No hard feelings. You know, they remove the inquiry against Jefferson. But again, he never forgets that slight that was done him by Patrick Henry. And what really hurts Patrick Henry's fame is William Wirt, his first biographer, is going to write to Jefferson after Patrick Henry's death, asking him for information on Patrick Henry, his subject. And this is where Jefferson just lets loose.
Oh, I see. He just unloads on old Pat. And okay, so that's going to hurt his reputation. Yeah.
So, yes, the idea of Patrick Henry loving money, fame, being a horrible lawyer, becoming a Federalist, hating Washington, all of this stuff is just Jefferson. Remarks to a Wirt that got in the biography, and of course other biographers taking from that. And most of these can now be disproven pretty easily, especially things like Patrick Henry couldn't read, he couldn't write, and silly things like that. But the damage, you know, is done. It's almost impossible to get these myths now.
You really don't want Thomas Jefferson against you. He's a hard guy to fight.
And when you outlive, 20 or 30 years longer than...
Sure, yeah, he sure did, and he was taking his vengeance. Okay, so the war's over, Yorktown, yay for us, it's the 1780s. What happens then?
So Patrick Henry, he goes back to the legislature. Some of the bills that he pushes for, marriage between Indians and whites, that was very controversial, but he thought this would be a way to create union.
Okay, so he was in favor of it.
What's that?
He was in favor of it.
Yes, he introduced the bill as a way to begin to Christianize the Indians, to basically win them over, educate them in the, you know, the...
To Europeanize them.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, right.
It is defeated because of just the animosity towards the Indians so close after the war. Even John Marshall said that that would have been a good bill that was defeated. He was for that Indian bill. And if you did marry an Indian, you were going to get tax breaks. Your children would be educated freely.
Whoa. This is beyond just saying it's okay to marry an Indian.
Yeah, he's encouraging.
He's encouraging. Okay.
Instead of wiping them out, let's... Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of interesting. Today you'd say, wow, how enlightened. But then when you look at the actual reasons, he was really arguing in favor of this is a way of essentially erasing the Indian culture. He was trying to absorb it into it and convert these people through marriage.
Yes, instead of annihilation of them. That's incorporate them basically into our way of life.
So what we would think of as an enlightened proposal for the not the most enlightened reasons. Okay.
Although, yes, if you look at his letters, he was saying to Christianize and what was the word he used?
Civilize them.
Civilize and Christianize, yes. He didn't
civilize
think
and Christianize.
Yes, that
All
was
right.
the
there we are.
Part of the letter.
All right, yeah, not the most enlightened of rationales.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking to Mark Cuvillon all about Patrick Henry. And as we've just heard, Patrick Henry was quite a conservative Christian. After the break, we'll continue our discussion with Mark, and then we will hear from one of our good friends at Montpelier. Stay tuned. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Now let's continue our discussion with Mark Cuvillon, all about Patrick Henry and his attempt to civilize and Christianize his fellow Virginians.
He also, if I recall, was one of those people. Yeah, you were going to talk about...
Yeah, with what happens with the church and state issue, in 1776, the Virginia legislature is getting so many... petitions from the Baptists and Presbyterians for a greater religious freedom, that they move to suspend the act requiring people to support the Anglican Church through taxes. So you no longer have to support Anglican ministers. And for the first time, you were no longer required to attend church, which up until that point, by law, everyone over 21, male and female, had to go to church one Sunday a month. So the first state legislature that meets in October of 1776, they suspend these acts. Now ministers are basically up to just the will of the parishioners.
The way it is today.
Yeah.
If you want to be a minister, you got to convince a parish or a congregation to hire you. And if they don't like you, they can fire you, and you're out of a job. So you're not getting a steady paycheck from the state. And I'm guessing that the Anglican ministers did not particularly like this.
No, I mean, and, you know, it's during wartime. Taxes are already heavy. If you have the option not to pay taxes, are you going to do it?
Yeah, it was not a good time for taxes. Okay, I understand that. Okay, so that had been done away with during the Revolution. But Patrick Henry wanted to reinstate it, didn't he?
Exactly. So
that's where I started getting sort of shocked about the Parsons case, because then he was against the Anglican ministers. Now he comes out in favor of them. So what's up with that?
And well, I mean, first you have to realize, you know, how religious Patrick Henry is, and also...
But that, too, kind of strikes me, because he was just talking them rapacious and other nasty things.
Yes, a handful of bad apples, as it were, he was attacking.
Oh, I see. That's the way he saw it.
Yes.
He was just attacking a few of the bad ones, but
and,
in general, he was very religious.
And the connection, yes, in some cases, between the Anglican Church and state, he thought was too tight. So what's happening is 8 years has gone by where you have voluntary support of the churches and the ministers, and people aren't supporting them from one way. They don't have the money, or they just don't want to. And so churches are closing. They're run down. Many of the Anglican ministers have to give up the cloth. They can't support themselves any longer. Some go back to England, some find other employment. And so in 1784, Patrick Henry makes a motion that what he wants to do is, instead of having one church established in Virginia as before, the Anglican Church, he's pushing to have all Christian sects established, basically, all religions, Christian religions established in Virginia. So if you're a Baptist, your money will now go to support your Baptist minister. If you're a Presbyterian, the Presbyterian Church, Anglican, the Anglican Church. And one of the main reasons behind this is Patrick Henry is a huge believer in Montesquieu, the great political philosopher. And Montesquieu states that there are certain springs that motivate certain governments, and a despotic government, fear motivates. In a republic, virtue as the motivating spring. And Patrick Henry believed you could not separate public and private virtue.
And the wellspring of all that virtue was Christianity.
In his mind, yes. And others like Jefferson, they believe, well, you can get public virtue through education just as easily through religion. Because mm-hmm. public virtue basically is the idea of putting the needs of your city, your country, your town above your own personal needs, as well as, and again, Patrick Henry and many others believe you couldn't separate private and public. If you lie, cheat in private, you're going to do the same in public office. And so he sees the decline of virtue. Of course, this is also the time where the French deism is making its way into the States.
Oh, not those Frenchies.
It's fun being an atheist and a deist and so forth. And so to him, if we want to see this republic survive and not die at birth, we need to have a virtuous society. And so that is why he pushes the assessment bill to try to bolster up religion.
Not to take Henry's side in this debate, but I'll simply acknowledge that this was very much a Roman ideal, the ideal of civic virtue and mm-hmm. of virtue being an essential component of public life. If a people wanted to govern themselves without virtue, they were going to fail. So this simply happened to be his spin on how one generates virtue.
It's yes.
through religion, and specifically through the Christian religion.
True. And, of course, now that we are not living under a monarchy, but a republic where the people are now the rulers, he thought more so than ever this idea of public virtue is necessary.
And the accounts I've read of our ancestors and the way they behaved on a regular basis, I can see how Patrick Henry might look around and say, we need us some virtue.
Yeah, and okay. of course, right after the war, you have all these soldiers now heading back home, the cursing, the drinking, the
drinking
gambling.
Copious amounts of alcohol, and very common practice to have big kegs of whiskey at public elections and buying votes with whiskey and people, you know, reeling drunk through the streets and getting into fights and bad fights. I mean, yeah. gouging people's eyes out in fights. I mean, people were disfigured in these fights. So I can see how he might want virtue to come up. But his particular perspective was rather specific to mm-hmm. a specific religion, even though he was trying to be ecumenical within Christianity. And, of course, he runs flat up against our good friend James Madison. So what happened with that?
Well, the thing
is about 1784, right?
Yes, yes. And there was a push. Henry is already back in as governor for a fourth term when a lot of this debate is going on over the assessment bill. But, yes, there was a push to have it include all religions, but it was the legislature stuck with Christianity. And if you were a Muslim or Jew, you wouldn't be punished or attacked. You just they didn't think those religions were worthy
Real.
Enough to be
yeah.
supported
right.
through taxes. But again, you wouldn't
And you'd
be.
Still have to pay taxes.
In yes.
fact, I think the requirement was that you either show up at an Anglican or other Christian service or you're going to be assessed, right?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, if you didn't have a particular minister that the money was going to go to, then it was going to go to support teachers. So that was a kind of a
okay.
offshoot
well,
of
yeah.
it.
That's kind of an interesting thing. So you, well, I don't know.
And, you know, it's the idea that, well, they might not, they might be forced to pay for a religion that they don't belong to, but they will get the ramifications, you know, brotherly love, you know, they'll get the benefits of a Christian society. So, I mean, you can kind of look at it like as Jefferson believed public virtue can be won through an educated society, which Henry wasn't opposed to. He was for educated society, but he thought Christianity was the base.
So of the teachers virtue. They would have been supporting would have been Christian teachers.
In this bill, yes.
Yeah, okay. So they were supporting the Christian religion one way or the other,
yeah.
even if they didn't designate a minister. But, of course, when this comes up, this bill comes up.
Yeah, it actually passes the first two readings. Of course, every bill has to go through three readings in the legislature. And it easily passes the first and second. Patrick Henry thinks it's in the bag.
Right.
Madison, and this is probably, you know, a design of his, he helped to win support of Patrick Henry being nominated governor. So he wants Patrick Henry out of the legislature.
So Madison doesn't like this bill.
No, he doesn't
Madison
like the
Madison realizes
bill.
Henry's his great opponent, so let's kick him upstairs.
Yes, and again...
So he gets him elected governor and also gets the legislature to postpone the third reading, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So yes, Patrick Henry again thinks, you know, it's going to pass the third reading. He becomes governor. The bill is tabled. And then Madison offers Jefferson's statute for religious freedom, which Patrick Henry looked upon.
Well, before we get to that, though, he wrote his famous Memorial and Remonstrance of 1785,
yes,
where he basically put down the reasons why you shouldn't have a religious assessment, a religious tax.
Yes.
That's one of the most famous and most important documents in our religious history, or I should say the history of religious freedom in this country. But in the meantime, his good buddy, Thomas Jefferson, back in 1779, I believe, had drafted the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And this was exactly the opposite. I mean, this is, you know, complete religious freedom and no assessments, no state establishment of a church. Mm-hmm. That had not gone nowhere back in 1779. It had been sitting on a shelf someplace.
Yeah.
But then Madison pulls it out.
And I should mention that as early as 76, the legislature had brought forward the notion of a general assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And what they wanted to do is put in the papers to get the public's reaction to it. And yes, in 1779, Jefferson draws up the Statute for Religious Freedom. The assessment bill, an assessment bill drawn up by Edmund Pendleton, is also put forward. That was much more narrow than the one Patrick Henry was looking for. And so both are kind of tabled to get the thoughts of the public.
Oh, and I hate to stop there, but that's about all the time we have today for Mark Cuvion and his remarkable recitation of the history, the biography of Patrick Henry. And don't worry, there's much more to come. In the meantime, why don't we change gears slightly and for a few minutes talk about our old buddies at Montpelier. Jen Howell, how the heck are you?
Oh, Stuart, it's been too long.
It has been far too long, but here you are back on the show, and you can just see me grinning. Can people hear me grinning through the microphone? I always grin when I'm near Jen. What are we going to talk about today?
Well, we can talk about several things. I thought we'd talk about some exciting events that we've had at the Center for the Constitution lately.
Okay. Well, what are they? What happened?
Well, just a couple weeks ago, we had a fabulous event with Sandra Day O'Connor.
And Sandra Day O'Connor, there's a name I recognize. Did you get to shake her hand?
I got to sit next to her.
You got to
days,
sit so next, as close as you and I are today.
Just about that close.
Tremendous. Did you ever sneak your foot over and touch her shoe or something like that?
I did not play footsie with the Justice.
No footsie with the Justice, but you were that close.
I was that close, and
uh-huh.
It was.
What was that all about? What was she doing?
Well, we partnered with her organization, iCivics.org.
Oh yes, yes.
It's an online civics gaming enterprise,
mm-hmm,
that is very, very popular with students and teachers, where students can go online and play games and learn all about their government. And so we partnered with iCivics to do we called it a salon.
Mm-hmm.
It's a salon to talk about
that sounds pretty highfalutin.
The future of civic education, specifically with regard to technology,
mm-hmm,
and how we can leverage emerging technologies to further the endeavors of civic education.
Which is right up your alley, since you basically run the website for the center.
It was sort of right
and you do
right
the,
there
you
at
do,
the intersection
you do the
of
context
worlds.
And all that other computer
That's
stuff.
Right.
So this must have been very exciting for you.
It was incredibly exciting for me. And we really tried to think outside of the box.
Mm-hmm.
It was a collection of civic educators, people in the technology field, philanthropists, other digital publishers. We had a global moderator that brought us all together and got us really, really thinking about some innovative ways to further civic education.
So what pearls of wisdom dripped from the justice's lips? I seem to recall a really cool post you put on Facebook.
Oh, would that be the one where I was sitting next to her?
Yeah, I saw that. I saw the picture sitting next to her. But you also said at some point someone made a comment and she made a point of thanking that person for the comment. It was about the education, that we need to improve civic education, something of that sort?
Well, yes, yeah, certainly. The justice is incredibly passionate about this topic.
Right.
And she really is trying to find ways within the existing school structures to get kids excited about learning. She particularly has some really innovative ideas in working with school districts and administrators within the school districts to get kids involved in service learning projects and community projects. Mm-hmm. Because I think it all starts with a passion. It's not enough to just teach kids the basics about our government. What you really have to do is get them excited about something. Make it a habit of the heart for them to participate in their government.
So, short version, Sandra Day O'Connor, passionate justice.
Absolutely.
The passionate Supreme Court
Absolutely.
Justice. Tremendous. What else is going on at Montpelier or has gone on recently?
Well, we just hosted an exciting authors conference with our partners at the Brookings Institution.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had several policy analysts and some scholars and a few of them from Montpelier.
Mm-hmm. And what were they talking about?
They're working on a volume of essays that will come out in the spring on Madisonian thought in contemporary public policy.
Ah, so is Madison still relevant to public policy? Is that the basic question they were debating?
That is the basic question.
And what did they decide?
They haven't yet.
They haven't yet. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think our authors are falling on both sides of that question.
Well, that actually speaks well for you, because I was about to joke that, of course, anything sponsored by the Center for the Constitution at Montpelier would be all about how relevant Madison is. But the fact that there are those who are on the other side of that question suggests that was a really legitimate conference then.
I think so. And it really falls in line with what the center tries to do all the time, which is present the facts, not take a side. Make sure that people are as educated as they can be in order to make their own decisions.
Okay, tremendous. I still think that the people who don't think Madison is relevant are clearly wrong, but that's just me. That's just me. Okay, the center's not going to take a side.
And no one on this show is going to see me wink at you.
All right. Well, those are the two you wanted to talk about, or was it something else?
Those are the big two. You know, we have some other exciting events coming up. 7 members of the Burmese Parliament that will be joining us.
Cool.
To talk about the amendment process.
Oh, cool.
And, of course, we have our full suite of seminars for educators and law enforcement officers that were.
And we'll be talking more about that in the future. Absolutely. Now, anything new with context?
Funny you should ask.
Well, I know that you're in charge of context.
Well, within the past 2 weeks, we just launched a brand new website.
Really?
Same idea, brand new look.
Tremendous. Where do people go to look at the context website?
Well, they can go to montpelier.org and click on the Center for the Constitution, or go straight to context.montpelier.org.
And just for the uninitiated, there are a couple of them still out there, what is Context again?
Context is an online crowdsourcing project where we're taking the most important documents in world history, and we are letting scholars and the public annotate them so that they make just a little bit more sense to the rest of us.
Okay, so that's cool. So it's this marginalia. You get to make your own notes on these important constitutional documents, like, that's a really dumb idea, or really way cool, something like that?
Well, we try to be a little bit more scholarly than that.
Oh, okay. Well, I better go back and edit the ones I put up there. I put several way cools on there last week, and maybe I should go back and rephrase that.
Well, we try to make our annotations as authoritative as possible, mm-hmm. though there is space if you do want to make that this is way cool comment. There is a discussion feed as well, so we're providing space for all types.
Tremendous. Well, Jen Howell of the Center for the Constitution at Montpelier, thanks so very much for coming on the show again.
Well, thank you, Stuart. It was a pleasure.
And that's our show, the second part of our 3-part series on Patrick Henry and Red Hill. Thanks so much to Hope Marston and Myra Trent, and of course to Mark Cuvillon, who told us all about Patrick Henry. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Nick Rosa and Bob Hoffman. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our theme song is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. And my name is, of course, Stuart Harris. Remember, you are a part of the American experiment.